Hi, welcome to When Songs Mean Business. I'm your host, Steph Belcher. This week's episode is full of amazing life advice from a professional musician turned financial planner, Justin Powell. Justin is a classically trained musician who discovered rock music and went on to perform with some of the best musicians in the improvisational jam band rock scene. He was a core member of the Montrose for many years, helping them run their festival, and he's also very active in the Asheville music scene, setting up cool events like the Soul Jazz Jam and playing with Blue Bop, a Bella Fleck and the Flecktones tribute band. Justin and I talk about entrepreneurship, managing a business, planning festivals, being alcohol-free, tips on how to control anxiety, meditation, goal setting, parenting and family stuff, financial management, songwriting, and even more. I hope you enjoy listening to this one as much as I did recording it. Please check the show notes for Justin's contact information. And as always, please reach out with any questions you have. I am here for you. I want to help you build your business. I want you to operate with confidence and security. And I want you to get out there and kick some ass. If you want to support this podcast, check out our Patreon page. And please follow us on Instagram at When Songs Mean Business. A quick disclaimer for this week's episode. Security and advisory services are offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor member, FINRA SIPC. Financial Resources Group Investment Services member, FINRA SIPC is a separate entity. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal professional. All right, let's jump in to this week's episode of When Songs Mean Business. Justin Powell, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Good to be here, Stephanie.
Yeah. So I love to start at the beginning of your story, wherever that is for you. When was kind of your first memory of music, or when did you get involved with performing or playing music as a child?
So it began on the violin at around age five, which is good for ear training because violins are very hard to make sound good, and quickly shifted over into piano because we had a piano in our home. And my parents noticed around age five or age six, I was going over, and this was in the early 80s, like picking out themes from movies or television shows, like Close Encounters of the Third Kind was one I kind of pecked out on my own. They said, oh, he's got an ear for it. And my dad played clarinet and piano. He's a pretty good classical piano player. So they got me into piano lessons. And, you know, long story short, I took to it pretty well. And that by the time I got to high school, I was in a music school going to classes, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day after regular school, studying classical piano and, you know, competing in concerto competitions, learning the, Anglican approach to the church organ. So even was looking at maybe going to school to be a church organist and choir master. And then I started listening to Pink Floyd and, you know, started to shift away. I looked at most of my, you know, teachers and whatnot were grossly underpaid. And, you know, I said, well, you know, there might be more glory in this rock and roll thing over here. And so I kind of shifted gears away from that path and wanting to do more like jazz and pop and rock, but didn't go right into college for it. You know, really didn't think I wanted to be a professional musician. Like at that time, I thought, you know, my dad was a businessman. I thought maybe I'd want to follow in his footsteps. And so didn't really pursue it for a while until I lived in around the Asheville area, which is where I am now, Asheville, North Carolina, and started playing in some bands and, you know, getting the feel for it and took to it. And then at some point said, you know, I really should gain a deeper understanding of this side of music and the theory behind it. And so I applied to get into the jazz program at Western Carolina University, where I completed the program there on jazz piano performance. And, you know, that's kind of the upbringing that got me to actually being, you know, a professional musician. So
awesome. Were your parents supportive of your transition into rock music?
Yes and no. They were always supportive of me, and they're great parents. They're a little old school. Like, my dad was born in 41 and in 1941. So they didn't really understand it, but they weren't necessarily not supportive or anything like that. So
my dad actually, I had to choose whether I wanted to be in band or choir. I could only take one. Mm-hmm. And he played me Great Gig in the Sky. And he said, I had been taking piano lessons up to that point, but I loved singing. And so he said, do you want to play the piano in this song, or do you want to be the vocalist? And I was like, of course I want to sing this song. Like, have you heard it?
I'd be able to use that for my daughter who's 7. Yeah, that's a great idea. That's really cool.
He was like a gigantic Pink Floyd fan. He would, you know, at one point he bragged about following them, which at the time meant 4 shows in a row.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Not like we're used to that. You know, the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's awesome. So what have you been doing lately with regards to music?
Yeah. So, you know, after college, I joined up with a band out of Greensboro, North Carolina, called the Mantras, who are still touring and playing out today. And we were in that kind of progressive jam band genre. Think Humphreys McGee, String Cheese Incident. Sure. I like to think of us kind of the Southern answer to Humphreys McGee. We, you know, double lead guitars. Okay. Everybody was really good players. Most had music degrees. So there was a deep understanding of composition and virtuosic playing. And we did a bunch of shows with Humphreys, and we toured up and down the East Coast and kind of all the way over to Colorado. Before I left the band, they've gone further since, but playing all the festivals along the East Coast, working with bands like Dopapod. And I think we did a 22 show run with Dopapod 1 year up and down. We traded shows with those guys. And so then we used to host a festival every year, and we'd have, you know, 30 or 40 bands, probably 1500 people would show up. It's kind of centered around us. We'd do 2 sets a night, 3 nights. And so I was the kind of the manager of that, you know, production coordinator. Like, I wore a lot of hats that weekend, and kind of hit the wall, like, you know, with just touring and that lifestyle and you know, the work for what felt like very little compensation a lot of the times, you know. And so I was really kind of at a crossroads with what I wanted to do with my career. And 4 days after that festival, my wife informed me that she was pregnant. And I said, that's interesting. And I remember I said, thank God, when she told me. She goes, I thought she'd be upset because of the band. I said, oh, no, this is what I've been feeling, right? This baby that's in there. And I said, we'll figure this out. I said, figure this out, but it'll go well. And so I called a couple of friends who are successful in the business, a little further along than we are, or were at the time, called Kofi, a little name dropping here, called Kofi Burbridge from Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi's band, who, rest in peace, passed away a couple years ago. He's a good friend and a mentor. And I said, you know, I don't know what to do, Kofi. We're having a baby and we're doing 180 shows a year. I just don't know what to do here. How do I make this work? And he said, are you making any money yet? Yeah, some, not enough, you know. And, you know, keep in mind, gas was like $4 a gallon at this time. A lot of our profits were just going back in the gas tank. And so he said, well, Justin, he said, I got 2 failed marriages that say you should probably take a break. And it's something I'll never forget that. And his brother O'Teal plays with John Mayer and the Dead, and was with the Allman Brothers for years. And he said, you know why the Allman Brothers stopped touring? This was right after they had announced that. I said, well, Greg's older, Derek's doing his thing, Warren's got government, you know, I figured it's just, you know, they're dialing it back or whatever. And he said, well, O'Teal and his wife found out they were pregnant, and he made a commitment to spend the first 5 years of his, I believe it's his daughter's life, off the road. So he didn't miss those formative years. And I said, well, that tells me everything I know, need to know. I called a couple other buddies in the business and they kind of had the same take. So I stepped away and moved back to, we're in Waynesville, North Carolina. So we're near Asheville, but just a little bit outside where my parents are. And kind of got just said, well, I'm not just going to get a regular job. I have a business minor from college. I managed the band. I kind of ran, you know, managed businesses. And, but, you know, buddy worked at a local bank and said, you know, hey, I can get you on here, you know, for health insurance, all these things that you maybe don't think about as an artist, but you definitely need to think about as a parent. Right. Yeah. And so I started at the bank. And was the weirdest first day of my life, for sure.
Going was that your first like professional job?
It wasn't, but it had been a while, you know, yeah. it had been a while. And going from the band van to the bank was quite a transition. But
did you wear a tie every day?
I did, yes. And, and so I... but I embraced it as an opportunity and, you know, as to just kind of build the resume towards wherever I was headed, which I wasn't sure at that time. All the way, you know, and then during that time, I played in a Bela Fleck and the Flecktones tribute act called Blue Bop. We're the only known Flecktones tribute act. It's kind of hard to pull a band like that together, right? You know, you need a really good banjo player and
really good bass player.
All these different, you know, like really great players. And my friend Hank Smith, who's based in Raleigh, organized that. And, you know, so that kept the finger, you know, my dad passed away about that same time and had a baby on the way and things were just kind of in flux. And I didn't know if I even could do the gig. And he said, you need to do the gig. It'll be good for you. And you got to keep your fingers moving. And it'll, yeah. And I was like, yeah, you're right. So I went and did it. We did a couple of tours and it was great. And then moved back and some buddies have a Southern rock band, Sanctum Sully. So I play keyboards for them. Greg Majors, who works with Humphreys McGee, mixed our last record. It sounds great. I work with Josh Phillips Folk Festival, which is another kind of roots act. We've got an album in the works right now. We just did a show with Acoustic Syndicate down here, which was really great. So still kind of get to dip my toes in and I cherry pick things. I play in the church every Sunday. We have a really good praise band. So that's something to do every week. That's fun and sounds good. That's kind of my rule. It has to, you know, there's got to be a certain level of quality to get me away from my desk working or my house to go to it.
So, yeah.
And I've found a nice balance there with the various projects that I'm working with now. So
that sounds great.
Oh, and there's one more, Alibaba's Tahini, which is a Humphreys McGee side project. We have that was Jake Sinninger's band before he was in Humphreys McGee. And I'm on the last two albums as co-writer and keyboardist. So
awesome. It's
yeah.
It sounds kind of like you're living the dream almost.
A little bit. Yeah, it's best of both worlds right yeah. now. Because after the bank job, I was recruited by a financial advisory firm and worked with them for about 5 years, handling client investments, active wealth management, financial planning, that sort of thing. And then about a year ago, I went out independent. And so currently an independent wealth advisor partnered with a boutique firm out of Asheville called Valor Private Wealth. And again, we do robust financial planning, active investment management, wealth planning, and those insurance, those types of things. So
awesome. That yeah. sounds great. Did your festival planning experience help you with transitioning into any kind of like a business role?
Yeah. So I think if I had just been playing keyboards and not looking at spreadsheets and, you know, cash flow thing, you know, stuff of that nature, it would have been a little harder to transition.
Yeah.
Because most, you know, often artists are, somebody handles that for you. And now a lot of that's done in-house. Like you have to do a lot, DIY it, right?
Yeah.
But I felt like when I went back to school for music, I was like, what do artists typically lack? outside of the music, it's or art or whatever, whatever your medium is, it's business acumen. It's the ability to think about profit and loss. And the weird thing is taking something that comes from here and monetizing it, right? It's a kind of a strange thing. So when I was in college, I made sure to get a business minor because, I had gone back and I had worked in sales and some other roles, managing higher end restaurants and stuff like that. So I was like, well, how do I apply that to music? And Western Carolina University had a great, they married business with music very well there. So it worked out good.
That's so cool. I want to talk a little bit more about the festival planning, mm-hmm. if you don't mind. I think, that's something that a lot of the musicians that I talk to when we're doing tax appointments or whatever, they say that it's something that they would really love to do. You know, mm-hmm. their friend has a farm or whatever, but they have no idea where to start. So what advice would you give to a smaller band? Maybe they're improvisational, maybe they're a folk band, but any kind of smaller band that's not flush with cash,
right?
That wants to basically just get a bunch of their friends together in a field and play a bunch of music. How do you even start?
Yeah. Well, I think you look at the relationships you have with other artists. Like, who do you want to play your festival? I think it's important not to try to go too big too fast and understand that typically these are, it's hard to profit from a music festival. Even the big festivals that you see, those first 4 or 5 years were probably not profitable as they kind of built over a certain threshold that allowed them to profit. But when you're just getting started, I think sponsorships are probably the best way. If you play local venues, like partnering with that venue, so selling the banner above the main stage down to setting up a vendor area that you can charge vendors a nominal fee to come in and sell their wares. So looking for ways to kind of raise the money ahead of time. And working a budget, right? So you if you get the bands lined up, what your stage cost is going to be, your land, you go ahead and get that budget together. Then you your sound, your lights, whatever it is you're going to do, then you can kind of know how much you need and then set up your sponsorship tiers accordingly. Well, we need, $3,000-$5,000 sponsors, or we need this many $1,000. And then you could go out there and raise that money. That's probably the best way to get started, because then it's other people's money. they're getting advertised. You're basically selling advertising at your festival. And that's a way that can be done, if it makes sense for the artist, for sure.
Sure. And then you can kind of work the ticket pricing in to fill in the gaps or kind of cover the cost of the talent kind of thing.
Another big thing is to, if your friends want to get in for free, put them to work. Yes, you can come for free, but I need somebody to do this, or I need somebody to do that. Especially with local bands, everybody thinks that because they know the artist, they should be able to get a free ticket. Well, there's your volunteer crew. So
I love that. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I have a friend, she regularly does the whole Fish tour, but she does the green crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she hangs out for an hour afterwards, picks up all of the water bottles that everybody just leaves behind because they don't think about it.
Yep.
And then she earned her ticket, and then she, does the next day, and it's, she'll do the whole entire, she works remotely, so she can do the whole tour.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she goes to sleep at night after the show knowing she did something good. Yeah. Which is nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And, it's, I think with festival planning, like the hard things are the things that you don't think about that kind of come around to bite you on the back end. I remember having to get like 2 extra full-size dumps. You talk about dealing with trash. Hate to say it, but people leave. They go to Walmart, buy a tent, trash it, and leave it in the field. And the green crew's got to go through and pick all that up. Well, you've got to get it off the site. And so planning for, if you're doing a campout festival, planning for trash removal and realizing it's probably going to be more than you think it is, those back end costs. I guess really just to build a buffer in your budget for back end costs that maybe you didn't see coming is a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I went to one summer camp one year where we got evacuated for tornadoes.
I played summer camp one year. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. It's in Chillicothe, Illinois, for the listeners who aren't familiar with it, which is kind of the very top of like Tornado Alley.
Oh, yeah.
It goes through like Kansas and, you know, like the plains. So every May, they get this big storm system, and every May they have summer camp. And I remember I had just come off of getting a business minor myself, and they evacuated everybody, and then they let us come back on Monday, mm-hmm. which normally they wouldn't have.
Right, right.
But that year, I think this was, I'm pretty sure it was 2004, they let us come back. And I remember thinking, this is going to be really expensive for them to
yeah.
let us come back like this, because yeah. this is just throwing them totally off kilter of yeah. whatever their budget was. And yeah. I for a long time, I had wanted to do festivals. And yeah. that, I was like on the C3 Bonnaroo career mm-hmm. path, mm-hmm. but it started to feel a little bit too much as far as all the traveling and
it's a lot.
The yeah. amount of time to put in. Yeah. So when did you, you know, when you were putting on the festival, when did you really start planning it in the year versus when it actually happened?
Well, we did, I think they've done six of them. I was a part of two.
Okay.
While I was with the band, and we would pretty much start, you know, the month after the last one ended.
Wow. Right?
At least talking about the bands that we wanted, because, you know, bands book so far out in advance. If you want to get somebody for your event, you got to give them at least 6 months. And now tours are being planned, you know, a year in advance, sometimes further out. So, there's a lot to think about, working with the booking agents, getting, you know, all of that, making sure it fits in the band's routing. You know, there's so many, you know, little things you might not think about when you're first getting started, that if you can plan as far ahead as possible, you could kind of nip some of those things in the bud, you know.
Yeah, that's great. So let's talk a little bit about that musician community that mm-hmm. you were able to kind of tap into probably throughout your whole entire career. Justin and I, for the listeners who aren't maybe familiar, Justin and I are deep in the same musician community. We've known each other for a long time now through the Umphreys McGee community. And we know how tight and intimate it is, but how have those relationships benefited you? And maybe what advice could you give to our listeners as far as building a musical community, not necessarily just for a festival, but kind right. of like in general.
Yeah. To grow your opportunities, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Umphreys is a good example for me, and I'll just use how that kind of all panned out. You know, I'm a huge fan. Heard him in 2004 at Bonnaroo, the legendary coming out set of theirs, you know, their big real debut on the national scene. And I was standing I had heard of them, but I was standing in the crowd like, holy crap, that's what I want to do. You know, that looks like fun. And not knowing that they'd become friends and down the road. And, you know, long story short, I was going to music school. Carl Engelman, who's an Ollie Baba's Tahini, was actually working in a bakery there. And he's like Jake's songwriting partner. He's written a bunch of the Umphrey staples, Party and Peeps, Got Your Milk, all that kind of stuff. And so we started hanging out. We just developed a friendship. So some of it's luck, right? You know, I just kind of happened to know a guy who knows those guys. But we developed a relationship and a deep friendship. And that persists to this day, even though we're not really in the business anymore. We still stay in close touch. And so the importance of like relationships. And so it ended up his other band, Mother Vinegar, opened for Umphreys, and Joel and I ended up at the after party talking. And I asked for his email address. I said, hey, I know Carl, I'm in the music school. I'd love to pick your brain from time to time. So I think reaching out to people that are doing the things that you want to do, people surround yourself with people that are better than you at what you're trying to do, right? That whole adage. And so Joel was really gracious, always answering emails, you know, putting me on guest lists, making me feel very welcome. And so I always tried to, you know, to honor that and know that it was a special thing, that a lot of people would really like to have that interaction. So he was a good mentor. One of the things we did 2002, we hosted the Soul Jazz Jam in Asheville of some friends of mine. And it was a, just like it sounds, it was like taking jazz standards, putting a funky backbeat on them, and letting the community, you know, like come and play, and you know, the music community come out and play. And we got the idea to take the money that we were making, which wasn't a whole lot, and put it into hiring, like reaching out to, you know, artists that had a little bit more prowess and asking them to come. We'd put them up, show them a good time. They would play a set with the house band. And then we'd open the second set up for like area musicians to get up and play with these like really great players. That started with my friendship with Jeff Sipe, the drummer for, he was at Trey's band, Trey Anastasio's band, and Jimmy Herring, all these, he's just amazing. And Kofi Burbridge, who I mentioned before. So we started reaching out to those guys. We ended up, Kofi did probably 7 of them. Jeff probably did 10 of them. Grant Green Jr., Count Mbutu from the Derek Trucks, a lot of the Derek Trucks band guys, because and Aquaria Rescue Unit, because we were located kind of close to Atlanta, which is where that hub is. So we were able to, through one relationship, hey, you should call this person, you should call this person, you should call this person. And it turned out to be this really magical thing for about a year and a half. Future Man from the Flecktones came and did one on this. Snarky Puppy showed up one night before they were really big, and they were like, hey, can we sit in? We're like, how about? And it was like a slow night. They weren't really a slated guest. And we said, hey, you guys just want to play like 4 Snarky Puppy tunes for us? They got up on this tiny stage and played a short set. And so those experiences have led to friendships and relationships that last to this day, right? You know, and I think it's just seeing that, not being afraid to like engage with people that are doing maybe or a little further along in their career, because the way music works, we typically, most of us want to share our experiences with others so that others can come up and succeed as well. And that's what I've found with most artists that, you know, that are cool, that they'll spend the time, you know, so hopefully that answers the question.
Oh, totally. No, that was great. I concur. I try to tell my students all the time, you know, don't be afraid to ask the songwriter that you love if you can email them. The worst that they're going to say is no, thank you.
What's the worst that can happen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And taking people off pedestals, maybe that you put them on in your mind. Just normal. They're normal people that are just like you and me, and you know, have hobbies, and you know, it's not, it's cool like that. I think we tend to like, you know, we can get a little starstruck, you know, and I don't think that's necessary, you know, so.
Yeah, I agree completely. I also think that there's an element of perceived competition that doesn't necessarily exist. It was really more of collaboration and community that the talented musician, like the upper echelon of these musicians, they don't feel necessarily like competitive or jealous or anything like that. They're just trying to make the best art that they can.
Right.
And so when you're young and you're maybe a little bit envious, might be the emotion, then you perceive it to be that, oh no, I can't talk to that person because they're not going to share their secrets with me because I'm a keyboard player too. You know, like Joel could have said, no, I'm not going to tell you any of my secrets.
Right.
Because you're a keyboard player and you're going to steal my job, steal all my fans. But
I've thought about that. What it'd be like to kill Joel.
But there is abundance and there's plenty of fans for everybody. There's enough to go around, and you know, we don't have to be afraid of sharing these experiences.
Yeah. Well, and remembering that they were where you are at some point. So they understand.
Yeah.
And you know, nobody just starts out at the top, you know, or it takes a while to get there, and it takes, you know, somebody probably helped them along too, you know, so hopefully they want to share that with others.
Sure. Yeah, I love that. Do you consider yourself to be an entrepreneur at this point?
100%. Being an independent advisor, I own my own practice and my own business. And so, yes, definitely takes the entrepreneurial spirit to be successful in this business and in the music business, right?
Do you have any advice for how a musician who might only consider themselves to be a musician, you know, you mentioned earlier that you got a business minor because you had that experience through your father. So if somebody didn't necessarily have that experience, this is the first time that they're hearing, you know, that they should be business people too. What's a good place for them to start with entrepreneurship? Yeah.
I think to get started, it might be best just to get a good tax professional, right? So if you've got good revenue coming in, you know, a tax professional that understands your situation can look at your situation, make suggestions on how you might, you know, lessen your tax burden per se, because that can be a really hard thing. If you're LLC'd and, you know, you have, you know, cash flow and taxes and all these things, somebody who can really take a deep look at your situation and say, well, this is maybe a way you can, you know, save for yourself, prepare for the unexpected, create a possibly a work optional lifestyle in retirement. And then you might want to go see an advisor that can maybe work up a business, help, not a business plan, but, you know, a plan for that. Right. So, I think we, as artists, like tend to kind of float around and not really be plan or goal oriented. And if you can start pulling those pieces together with the aid of some professionals that understand your situation, right. That'll get you on the track to, you know, where you probably need to be as a business person. Goal setting is really important. Like, where do you want, you know, just vision boards, right? This is where I want to be. And these are the actions I'm going to take. Accounting is very important, right? So if you can't do it yourself, you know, working with somebody, your bookkeeper or something like that, but getting a handle on those things, it seems very daunting, but it goes back to what we were saying about reaching out to musicians that are further along than you. Well, you know, for your business, reach out to maybe somebody that is running a good business, right? Or is in one of those areas of expertise that we discussed. But yeah, you know, it's challenging because, you know, how do you balance creating art, pouring your emotion into your art, and then kind of shifting to the other side of the brain regarding that art and monetizing it and keeping track of those numbers. There's great apps out there too that are more, you know, it's probably harder 10 years ago when I was trying to do it. Now you can kind of keep track of a lot of this stuff just using your phone. So maybe seeking out some of those digital ways to manage the information that you would eventually take to say an advisor or a tax professional or an attorney or something like that. Those are always helpful too.
I love to hear you say that because this is basically my whole platform. And I preach this almost like to the point where I drive people crazy, you know, talking about, I believe that when you decide to become a professional musician, and there is a difference between being a hobby musician and being a professional, but when you decide to be a professional, that very first person that you should talk to is a financial advisor.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is a common attitude in the music business. They think I need a manager. I need a publicist. They think I need the fans before I can build the business. And I've seen so many people in tax appointments that sat across from me and wavered back and forth about whether or not they were actually in business.
Right.
And it's a mindset thing.
Yeah.
Where if you don't think you're actually in business, you're not going to go full in on your marketing.
Right.
You're not going to feel emotionally comfortable promoting a product that isn't solid and stable and has a foundation of protection and has a bank account. You know, I always say, like, you can't start your marketing until you have a bank account to put the money in. And you can't get a bank account until you have an EIN, and you can't get an EIN until you have an LLC. And it's this whole thing, right? And so people are like, why isn't my marketing working? And as we kind of dive deeper into it, I'm like, well, your mindset doesn't think that you're actually in business.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point.
You know, yeah. So, and it always starts with the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, the title of this podcast, When Songs Mean Business. If we don't have those good songs, if we don't have some kind of intellectual property that people are interested in hearing, then you don't have anything to sell anyway. Right. So right. Let's talk a little bit about songwriting.
Yes.
I am not a good songwriter. So I feel a gigantic debt of gratitude to the people who do write great songs. So I want to hear about your songwriting experience.
So I think of myself more as an arranger and performer, right? So my involvement with songwriting is usually very collaborative, right? For example, with Carl from the Alibaba's Tahini project, that started with us co-writing some stuff, you know, that we didn't really plan on putting it on the Alibaba's Tahini album when we were co-writing it. We're just kind of getting together for fun and playing. And he's like, I've got some stuff. And I, you know, we'd get to a section. I'd be like, oh, what if we put these chords there or that this here, we move this there, sort of arranging a little bit. And then we would just co-write a couple of tunes as well. We'd pick a subject matter, find a riff or something that we liked or we'd come up with prior and start putting words to it and melodies and that sort of thing. So for me, having grown up a classically trained musician, it was really more about performance as opposed to composition. And it was a very lonely pursuit, you know, studying classical piano. I'm sitting by myself in my house in middle school and high school while my buddies are out playing basketball. And it always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, you know, and like, this is really lonely. So now when I think I have an aversion to kind of working by myself. That's something I've never really gotten through. It's a problem, but it's part of who I am, I guess, at this point. So I really enjoy that kind of collaboration, playing in bands, arranging together, or just like co-writing, bouncing ideas off each other. And that's kind of like how I like to do business too. I have a great business partner. We talk just about every day about marketing ideas or, you know, clients we're partnering on. And there's something about that collaborative spirit that really gets me fired up. And that's how I kind of approach songwriting as well. It's like, if I have an idea, I'm going to reach out to a buddy of mine who's like a really good songwriter and say, hey, let's work on this together. You can help me make this better. Or if they're a really good songwriter, but maybe they need to add a little more sophistication to their song, like harmonically or something like that, that maybe is where I fit in for them. So
that's cool. That's really cool. Have you been publishing your own work?
No, and we were going to kind of go back to that. I'm glad you brought that up. Start your own publishing company. Like that's a really, you know, especially if you're planning on like selling your music, you know, beyond performing it live or just, you know, putting it out on iTunes or whatever. If you're, you know, going to sell to television or, you know, owning those publishing rights, I mean, there's plenty of stories. Like you look at Prince, you look at Tom Petty, all these folks that would battle with record companies for their publishing rights. You know, most of the bands that we know and follow, they have their own publishing companies. They can control all of that. You know, you want to speak to an attorney about that, of course, but it's one of those things that I think is really important. So I've always kind of, I've let that go. Thankfully, not much of my music has made much money in that area. So I haven't really lost anything because of it. But in retrospect and knowing what I know, I think if you're looking to really sell your music and place it in certain places, owning those publishing rights is important.
That's great. So we were talking earlier about like the Bella Fleck project. And I want to talk for a minute about cover songs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And arranging them in unique ways. That's one of my favorite things about music is hearing an old song a new way. Is that something that you...
I love doing covers that way. So the Mantras, who has had in for a good while, we prided ourselves on really doing covers justice musically, but also putting, you know, not being so stringent. It didn't have to sound like that band. The music had to all be there, but we wanted it to sound like us doing it. And so we did some really cool covers. I mean, everything from Pink Floyd to stuff that was difficult because it was a bunch of good players. And then with the Flecktones stuff like that, we were trying to, because it's the Flecktones, we were trying to nail it and make it sound like the Flecktones, right? Because nobody had done that, you know? And it's like, it's such challenging music to play that we said, well, this is a challenge we accept. And we did a pretty good job. We got the thumbs up from Bela Fleck and from Howard Levy, and Hank works with Bela through the banjo summit every year. And so they know each other really well. And so we got on Twitter, I think he was like, this is great. Glad to see people playing the music. And there's videos out there. The project's called Blue Bop, tribute to Bela Fleck and Flecktones. You can go onto YouTube and see us do it. And if it wasn't good, I would say take those videos down. But it was. We did a pretty good job with it. So yeah, I love playing covers, and being that I don't write a whole lot of original music, and then most of my writing and songwriting is collaborative. Covers, not only is it good ear training to like try to learn something, right? It keeps those ears sharp. It's just fun to play music that you love, right? For a crowd of people that you know they love it too. If you place those songs strategically in a set, especially if you're in a new market, you know, that's the thing that you might be able to grab that new fan with. Well, it's like that cover song. And then like, oh, these guys are good. Oh, they did a great cover of that song that I really like. And then they're kind of hooked, right? So.
Yeah, totally. How do you build a set list? Do you have a method for it?
When the Mantras, we did a lot of transitions, right? So, you know, we would maybe do the first half of one song into another song, and then, you know, finish the first half of that song that we had transitioned out of, right? You're familiar with jam bands do that a lot. So there was a lot of thought into like, what key are we in? How does this flow and transition? And then, you know, coming out, you know, and especially in the rock bands, like coming out really intense to grab their attention, and then giving their ears a break with something maybe, you know, after three or four songs with something a little more laid back. Because if you just come at people constantly hard the whole time, you know, they might need to step away. You don't want to lose them. So I think having that ebb and flow of intensity versus, you know, not so intense is really good. You know, the ubiquitous encore, like, you know, it's always funny, like walking off the stage and coming back out, and you typically putting like a cover, maybe a cover in the encore or something like that to remember, just try to grab those new fans. But you know, that's the kind of the extent of it, is trying to have it flow really well. And if you have any transitions built in, making sure those keys match up or resolve well to the next song. So
cool. My dad told me one time that there's like a specific way that baseball managers build a baseball lineup. Mm-hmm. And it's like the first person just needs to get on base, and mm-hmm. he needs to be a fast runner because he's going to try to steal a base.
Right.
And then the second person needs to be able to advance that first runner.
Right.
And then hitters 3 and 4 are always home run hitters.
Yeah. Because you got to load the bases up, and then you knock them home. Right.
Yes, exactly. Great analogy. And then 5, 6, 7, you know, you're still just trying to like, you're given a little bit of a break, but and I thought that was a great analogy for building a set list too.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. That's really good. Yeah.
It
applies for sure. Yeah.
Cool. So one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you today is because we share a common alcohol-free lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I was wondering if you would be comfortable talking a little bit about your alcohol-free journey and how it relates to the music business, and maybe sharing some advice with people who are questioning their relationship with alcohol and are, you know, maybe a little bit anxious about what that's going to look like when they're sure. in and out of clubs all the time.
Yeah, we, you know, you and I were talking before about, you know, when you're in the music business, you're in the business of throwing a party for people every night, right?
Yeah.
That you're out working, and it can get challenging to not take part in that party, you know, as it, that becomes your environment, that becomes, you know, where you are. So I, like many musicians, was, you know, part of that party and the backstage and, you know, enjoying the alcohol and the revelry. And, you know, looking back, but now that I'm alcohol free, about a year and a half now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The way I feel now, health-wise, mental clarity, you know, not to say I have regrets, but looking back, I wonder what my career would have been like had I been alcohol-free during that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you start to learn about what alcohol does to the body, to the brain, it's not really good for fine motor skills or mental clarity or, you know, rational decision making, right? So things that as a business owner you need, and let's face it, when you're putting on a show, you're working, and you people have paid money to come see you play, and you need to put that best foot forward. And so I think about that, and of course you can't go backwards, but I have played several shows. Obviously COVID kind of got in the way of us playing lately, but it's starting to kind of happen again. And doing them alcohol free is like this whole new experience, and I'm so much more present in my playing and with what's going on, and I'm not there, you know, to throw the party and be a part of the party. I'm there to really live in the art and live in the moment, and it's something I'm really cherishing now as I'm getting to experience that. So
I love that. I often wonder if introverts who want to make music alone, or, you know, not necessarily alone, but want to make music, and then they have to go perform it, and they maybe feel uncomfortable. You know,
yeah.
They call it liquid courage, and I don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, I think the first one or two work that way.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Do you have any tips for how somebody who's not necessarily comfortable kind of like putting themselves out there in a live setting.
Yeah.
They've been using alcohol as a way to
get over the hump. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. You know, I experienced that too, just that nervousness. And I mean, I talk to guys that have been in the business 20 years, 25 years, they still get butterflies before they go out. And the bigger the crowd, the easier it is to get nervous. Right. Yeah. That's a tricky thing, right? And I think a lot of the alcohol abuse and even drug abuse comes from insecurity and, you know, and trauma. We're learning that it's coming from trauma and things like that too. But for artists, I think really it's that insecurity. Like, I'm putting myself out there. I don't know if these people are going to like me. Mm-hmm. I need them to like me. And this, you know, a couple of drinks makes me not care about it as much, right? So I'm able to kind of ignore it. So, like, what can you do other than that? I think an alcohol-free lifestyle comes with, like, being conscious about your diet, being conscious about exercise, being conscious about so many other things that you besides the alcohol, because, you know, the alcohol goes away and you're feeling good, you're sleeping better, you're waking up earlier, which is when most of the business world is doing their business anyways, right? So for me, yoga has been really powerful in terms of my physical health and my mental health. And so I try to have a daily yoga practice. I've got a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. Sometimes I can't get it in, but I really try to get that in and have that 30 minutes to an hour of physical meditation, meditating, deep breathing exercise. Gosh, 3 deep breaths, right? One of the most powerful things to bring you down from that anxious level. And I think when you learn about how alcohol really exacerbates your anxiety in the long run, especially if it's being abused at all, or you have a use disorder, you know, having those techniques, you know, those breathing techniques, or being able to get to a meditative space before you go play, before you walk on stage. Now, when I go walk on stage, I take 3 really, really deep breaths. And I try to close my eyes. I'm like, gosh, Justin, you've been doing this a long time. There's nothing to be nervous about. You know the music. And then I walk out there and I live in the moment, and it's way better than the way it was before, which was, you know, maybe had a couple before I got up there, maybe had a couple more while I'm on stage. And then, you know, it's not as good. It's just not as good.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you completely. I credit my daily meditation practice with moving me from an abusive alcohol situation that I've been very open about this. I'm happy to talk about my abusive alcohol, but it came from a lot of going to concerts, going to the parties, being backstage, having free alcohol, and feeling uncomfortable or socially awkward, and just, you know, wanting to not feel weird, not feel awkward.
Like you didn't fit in or something.
Yeah.
You're around all these big name artists, and if you're not part of their inner circle, you can kind of in your own head convince yourself that they don't want you to be there or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Like, I don't fit in. And then meditation helped me to identify those thoughts farther ahead than when they were actually happening and just reacting to them.
Yeah.
And so I was able to really hone in on what thoughts were actually real and which ones were just fear or not based in any kind of reality. And that has really helped me kind of get past it. But, you know.
Yeah. I was just saying, like, therapy, everybody needs therapy. Especially after the last 2 years you can find a way to access that. If you're dealing with any sort of anxiety or depression, you know, it's important to get a handle on it, because that can slip into drug problems and alcohol problems that they're just so slippery. Like, you almost don't even realize they're happening until it's too late. And I've seen it both ways. Like, I've had to, you know, bury friends in the business that went so far down that road that they never came back. And then I know a lot of really successful artists that are alcohol free and drug free. And so, and you look at them and you compare kind of the two, and you're like, well, what do I want for myself? And so just understanding the slippery nature of that and how you can kind of wake up one day in a spot that you never saw yourself in, trying to nip that stuff in the bud before it happens. Right?
Yeah. And I think it involves a certain element too of long-term planning and thinking about your goals and thinking about the bigger picture vision for your life. You know, part of the reason why I had to quit alcohol was because it was making me physically ill.
Yeah.
And I realized my dad actually passed away from male breast cancer when he was 53. Oh. Yeah, which now that I'm about to turn
10 years from now, right, for me.
Right? Like, that's so young.
Yeah.
And I realized if I keep abusing my digestive system in this way, it's going to start backfiring on me as autoimmune disorders and possibly cancers. And, you know, I realized I needed to join the clean living train.
Yeah.
And that's because I want to live into my I want to meet my great, great grandchildren, kind of thing, God willing. And you had said something earlier that I wanted to come back to with regards to money. And I'm hoping that we can tie it in somehow, but you said a work optional lifestyle.
Yeah.
Work optional retirement.
Right.
And that sounds like such a beautiful dream, you know, to be in your 60s and be young, relatively young and healthy, and have a retirement fund, right? And have some cash that you can withdraw, whether it's tax-free or taxable, which, you know, there's different routes that you can go. But I just I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, like, looking farther down the road. How do you plan ahead? How, you know, knowing that you are creating these pieces of intellectual property that hopefully will gather steam as you get older. So I'm kind of tangenting now, but
I think that's the importance of, like, going back to what we were saying about running your business like a business and then running your personal finances to complement the success of that business, right? So obviously, if we don't have any revenue coming in, this is going to be a hard thing to accomplish. So that needs to be the focus initially, is to get that. But there are ways, working with your tax professional, to set up, you know, various different retirement savings vehicles that, you know, some make sense for some make sense for others, just depending on where you're at. And then working with someone to make sure that it's set up in a way that it's automated, right? That's really, I think, the key. I always think about like savings and saving for retirement as, you can think of it as a bill that you pay to yourself, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So it's got to go out every month. It's got to go into this thing every month. And this is, it's just like my car payment. It's just like whatever else. It could be a percentage of your income. Obviously, income is variable. So I think with artists, it might be better to look like, okay, well, I know I've got this many guarantees this month. I know I'm going to do this percentage, you know, because I've worked with my advisor and my tax professional. And getting that going out, you know? So I think thinking of it, you know, again, it comes back to mindset, right? Like, what am I trying to achieve? Living in the moment is important on stage. when you're running your business, you've got to look out to the future. When you're running your personal finances, you've got to write, you know, I've got some clients that have recently experienced some really recent success, and they've been really great about making sure that as that success has come, that there's a plan around what that revenue is, that certain things are going here, going there, to plan for the future. COVID was really eye-opening, I think, for a lot of artists and just all of us, that everything we have can be taken away in an instant.
Yeah.
So to have some insurance, and I don't necessarily mean life insurance, but like, you know, an emergency fund or you know, a taxable account that you can pull off of if you need to live off of it, you know, things like that. Obviously a planner, a financial planner, a tax professional, a legal professional, all working together on your behalf can help you devise that plan. Right. So
yeah.
I have to be very high level about it. So when you talk with these people, you know, you tell them what your goals are. I think that's the other important piece. It's like, what are my goals? Mm-hmm. Do I want to be on stage till I'm 90? Probably not. Do I want to have that work optional lifestyle? And obviously, we want to play music, but do we want to have to be touring? You know, those types of questions. You can put numbers to that. Like, what do I need to live on? What do I need to save today based on a certain rate of return to get that kind of base level that I can pull an income off of? Like, that's where we come in, you and I, to help artists and musicians and just our clients in general kind of identify what those numbers are and what those strategies can be. So
cool. I love that. Can people hire you?
Yes, can.
Great. I'll put all that information in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
I'll be able to link to you. Yeah. So this has been fantastic. I just have one last question for you.
Yeah.
What have you been listening to lately?
Oh, what have I been listening to lately? Corey Wong lot.
Yeah, he's in the family.
I was going to say, do you know Dan Rosinski? His manager, he was kind of in the scene there with us in Chicago.
All those Wolfpack guys went to University of Michigan.
Yeah, they went to Michigan. Yeah. So
they're all, you know, I saw Theo Katzman on stage in Chicago at Martyrs playing with My Dear Disco, and it would have been in March of 2009.
Oh, wow. So you've been listening to for a long time.
Yeah.
I was
late to that too. I didn't see My Dear Disco in 2007. So I'm a noob.
Yeah, I'm definitely a noob. Corey and his band played with Sierra Hall at the Orange Peel in Asheville a couple of weeks ago. One of the best shows I think I've ever seen.
Wow.
I've seen a lot of shows. I'm listening to him. I was born in the 70s. So like in the 90s, like I was listening to like a lot of electronic dance music and stuff. I grew up in Atlanta. So I've been listening to a lot of chill house and stuff like that. Like it kind of creeps back in and creeps back out. I go through phases too, you know, like I'll be into 80s music for a month, you know, or Humphries is coming to town this weekend. So I've been kind of listening to some of their tunes and refamiliarizing myself with that. What else? That's kind of it right now. I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Oh, cool.
I spend a lot of time like learning and listening to podcasts and that sort of thing. So
me too.
Yeah.
I understand completely. I actually had to challenge, I realized that all I have been listening to for the entirety of quarantine and virtual school was mm-hmm. whatever my kids wanted to listen to.
There's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Disney stuff being played or
yeah. That actually, there's a Disney nursery rhymes CD mm-hmm. that was written by one of the guys from Tally Hall, or actually it was arranged by one of the guys from Tally Hall. But the arrangements of these Disney nursery rhymes are absolutely fantastic. And there's this
Send me a link to that. I love it.
It's yeah. so good. Your kids will love it. But yeah, so I was listening to like Julie and the Phantoms and the Hamilton soundtrack.
I'll send yes. you the Phantoms. Yes, definitely listen to lots of Hamilton.
So I challenged myself to listen to one album a day that's come out in 19, 20, 21
right,
that
right.
I might have missed.
Yeah.
And that has been really wonderful. That's a fantastic adventure for me. I got a little distracted by the Encanto soundtrack.
Yes, that's my son was singing that stuff this morning from Encanto.
It is just so stinking catchy. And I subscribe to the earworm idea that if it gets stuck in your head, you have to listen to it or it's going to just be there.
Right.
But like Bruno, no, does not ever leave my head.
No.
I'm just listening to that dang song all day long.
But what other group that I have been listening to a lot of is Scary Pockets.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so they
put out, that sings with them.
Yeah, they do so much. Just put out so much material and it's varied. It's all kind of modern funk, but I love funk music and I love soul jazz and instrumental stuff like that. So their Scary Goldings album, which is Mono Neon, Larry Goldings, the main guy, Jack, I can't think of his last name. From, yeah. Mm-hmm. And oh, the guitarist, I'm drawing a blank. But anyways.
Is it Ryan Lerman?
Could be.
I don't know.
Well, let's look. Anyways, we'll let people search Scary Goldings, great funk organ record. It's the fourth one that they've done. John Scofield is the guitarist.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
So, yeah,
really. Ryan plays with Scary Pockets. Was from the Michigan music scene. Knows a lot.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and it's funny. I didn't realize how big a scene that was until Wolfpack kind of came on the scene, and I was like, "Oh, wow, that's a great program that they've got going there." So
we're like a quiet secret, you know. It's really cool to be mm-hmm. here. I grew up in Cleveland, and then I moved to Chicago, and I felt like I couldn't have left Chicago. You know what? How could I have a music business anywhere besides Chicago?
Right.
And then I met my husband and he was from here and he was living in Chicago with me, but we came back here to visit and we went to the Electronic Music Festival and then mm-hmm. we went to Jazz Fest. And then I started to realize that the Motown families, the guys that made up the Funk Brothers and sections and everything, they never left. They didn't go to LA. Smokey Robinson and Berry Gordy did. And Diana Ross.
Yeah.
Nobody else did.
Yeah.
They're all still here and all their kids are still here. And they're all playing in church 3 times a week. It created this incredible music scene. And then U of M in Ann Arbor is a whole separate thing.
Right.
And then there's, you know, Green Sky Bluegrass coming out of Kalamazoo and May Erlewine and the Accidentals coming out of Traverse City. But since Michigan's kind of isolated, mm-hmm. we don't really get a whole lot of pass-throughers.
Yeah.
You know, people just driving through and like, oh, I'm going to randomly be in Michigan today, so I'll go see a concert. We don't get that.
Right. It's, yeah.
So we're just a little bit isolated. And so I live here and I see it and I hear it all the time. And I tell people, yeah, if you want to move to LA, go to LA, but just remember where you came from, you know?
Yeah. And be ready to work for it out there. Yeah. I've had several friends come back with their tails between their legs, and I've had several friends be very successful. And I think that goes back to like that whole mental health and lifestyle and staying on an even keel. If you're going to do Nashville, LA, New York, Chicago, any of the big hubs, make sure you keep your head about you.
Yeah, sure. Totally. I think also people don't necessarily always realize that LA is very fundamentally a film town.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're going to be on film. If you go to LA, you're going to be in videos. You're going to be, songs are going to be pitched for movies. You're going to be on TV. It's really not a town where you can go and have a successful career without utilizing that film industry.
Yeah, I'd say Nashville is really focused on the studio musicians. And of course, there's film involved in that too, just the nature of the... I think when you're talking about which hub you want to head to, it's like, what are you trying to achieve? Like, what do you want to do? You know, and Atlanta, you know, for you know, R&B and rap. And I've got friends that I went to college with that have Grammy nods for their guitar solos on Rick Ross albums because they posted up in Atlanta. And so, you know, and that suits that him as a musician, like in his style, like it makes sense. So I think finding the town that jives with you, you know, I love Chicago. It's just too cold. Like,
you're not from the Midwest.
I'm also like, I realized after living in Chicago, like I'm more of a small town person. Like I'm more comfortable, you know, in a smaller town. So knowing that about yourself, like, and discovering that, and not denying like where you really are comfortable, I think is important too. So
that self-awareness is key.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Is there anything else that you want to add or anything that you want to promote?
On the financial planning side, you know, if you have any questions, you know, Stephanie's going to put the contact information up here at the end. Happy to talk to you. See if we can't provide you some value in that space. And then, you know, from the music side, just always remember that the art comes first and everything you do, and things will be good regardless at that point. And thanks so much for having me on the podcast. You have the distinct honor of me, this being my first podcast that I was a guest on. So
yay. That's awesome. That warms my heart. I'm so glad to hear that. All right, thanks again.
Take care.
When Songs Mean Business is a production of Steph Belcher Business Management, LLC. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Steph Belcher. Please make sure to join us in our Facebook group, When Songs Mean Business, and follow us on Instagram at When Songs Mean Business. As always, thank you to The Dropout for the break music. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.